Well, we're going to be dealing with a very popular subject here in this talk, the subject of dinosaurs. Dinosaurs, of course, are one of the most spectacular and diverse groups of animals to have ever walked the earth. They came in a huge variety of shapes and sizes and included some of the most iconic fossil animals, such as Tyrannosaurus rex, which you can see here in this slide, the armoured Triceratops, the long-necked Brachiosaurus, and many others. Now, according to evolutionary theory, dinosaurs evolved in the Triassic period, about 230 million years ago, and dominated life on the land until their extinction at the end of the Cretaceous, about 66 million years ago. On the other hand, biblical creationists regard dinosaurs as land animals that were created on the sixth day of creation week, about 6,000 years ago. And in the creation model, dinosaurs coexisted with the earliest humans in the world before the flood, and the dinosaur fossils are a testimony to God's judgment of that world at the time of the global flood. Now, this is the first of two talks at this conference dealing with creationist research on dinosaurs. Steve Taylor is going to be talking about the work that he and his colleagues have been doing on soft tissue preservation and carbon-14 in dinosaur bones. But in this talk, I want to look at two other areas of dinosaur research. And for those who like alliteration, they both begin with the letter T. Firstly, I want us to think about taxonomy. Taxonomy. Taxonomy is the branch of biology concerned with classification. It's sometimes also referred to as systematics. Now, perhaps taxonomy sounds like rather a dry subject, but it is in fact one of the most important parts of biology, because the classification of organisms underpins everything else that biologists do. And this is no less true for creation biology than for evolutionary biology. As creationists, we want to know which creatures belong to which created kinds. And discovering those created kinds gives us a foundation for everything else. Understanding what changes have taken place within the created kinds, how quickly those changes occurred, how many animals were on board Noah's Ark, how those animals and their descendants repopulated the world after the flood, and so on. So in the first part of my talk, I want to look at the work that creationists have been doing to identify the created kinds, and in particular, what we've discovered so far about the dinosaur kinds. So that's taxonomy. But then secondly, I want us to think about taphonomy. Taphonomy is the branch of science that deals with all of the processes that go on between an organism dying and the discovery of that organism as a fossil. As creationists, we want to know, don't we, how animals came to be preserved in the fossil record. What were the circumstances of their death, their transport, and their burial, and so on. And so in the second part of my talk, I want to look at two examples of creationist research in the area of taphonomy. Firstly, the research that's being done on a remarkable Allosaurus fossil called Ebenezer. And then the work that's being carried out at an extraordinary dinosaur dig in eastern Wyoming. And I want us to think about what we can learn from both of these projects about the circumstances of the death and burial of these amazing animals during the global flood. So let's begin with a bit of an introduction to dinosaur taxonomy. Dinosaurs were first discovered and described by scientists in the 1820s and the 1830s. The first three dinosaurs to be scientifically described were Megalosaurus, named by William Buckland in 1824, Iguanodon, named by Gideon Mantell in 1825, and Hylaeosaurus, also named by Mantell, in 1833. Now, in 1842, Richard Owen, the great Victorian anatomist, founder of the Natural History Museum in London, demonstrated that these three reptiles shared features of the hip region that were lacking in all other reptiles. And so he proposed that they belong to a completely new group that he named the Dinosauria, meaning fearfully great reptiles. And since that time, since the first discovery of the dinosaurs, our knowledge of dinosaurs has grown exponentially, especially as a result of what's come to be known as the dinosaur renaissance that began in the late 1960s and really continues through to the present day. This renaissance has led to a much more dynamic view of dinosaurs as active, fast-moving animals with complex social behaviours. And it's also led to an incredible surge of new discoveries. Today there are more than 1,000 recognised species of dinosaurs, more than 85% of which have been named, believe it or not, since 1990. In fact, the pace of discovery today is faster than it has ever been. Every year, about 50 new species of dinosaurs are named, almost one every week. And many of those new discoveries are coming from previously underexplored parts of the world, such as China, India, and Africa. And they're joining the more famous and more iconic dinosaurs discovered in Europe and North America in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, for the creation biologist, all of this dinosaur diversity presents some obvious questions. How many created kinds of dinosaurs are represented among the 1,000 species currently known? And does the created kind correspond to some already recognized rank in the standard taxonomic hierarchy? Perhaps you're familiar with the standard taxonomic scheme that you can see here in this slide. It was introduced by the Swedish naturalist Carl Linnaeus in 1758. And it groups similar species into what we call genera, the singular is genus, and then genera into families, families into orders, orders into classes, and so on. The dinosaurs as a whole are classified as a superorder, which is a rank just above the level of order, between an order and a class. And within that superorder, there are many families and genera and species of dinosaurs. It seems likely, given all of this diversity, that these dinosaurs belong to many different created kinds. But how many? And how can we find out? Well, over the years, based on clues from both the Bible and from science, many creationists have suggested that the taxonomic rank of family may approximate the created kind. We have the dog family, and the cat family, and the horse family, and so on. And given this assumption, it's been estimated that there might have been perhaps 50 to 60 created kinds of dinosaurs. Well, that seems a reasonable assumption, a reasonable estimate. But how can we test it? Well, in the 1940s, a creation biologist by the name of Frank Lewis Marsh proposed that hybridization between species, in other words, the ability of species to interbreed and to produce hybrid offspring, could be used as a test to determine which species belonged to the same kind. In fact, it was Frank Lewis Marsh who coined the term baramin to refer to the created kinds, derived from the Hebrew words bara, to create, and min, meaning kind. And since that time, many creation biologists have adopted Marsh's ideas and sought to identify the original created kinds, or baramins, using hybridization studies. However, hybridization, although it's useful, has some obvious limitations, and perhaps you're already one step ahead of me. One of those limitations is that it's impossible to know whether two extinct organisms that we know only from fossils would have been able to hybridize. In other words, we can't apply Marsh's hybridization criterion to dinosaurs. So where do we go from here? Well, recognizing the limitations of the hybridization approach, modern creation biologists in the last couple of decades have proposed a range of different criteria that we can apply to identify the created kinds besides just hybridization. These include what we might refer to as additive criteria. In other words, criteria that allow us to put species together into the same kind. And subtractive criteria that allow us to separate species into different kinds. This new discipline that has become known as baraminology, the study of the created kinds, was only founded in the 1990s, but it's now developed into a very dynamic field of creation studies in its own right, with its own conferences and its own publications. New baraminology studies are published every year. So how does baraminology work? Well, it doesn't try to identify each created kind or each baramin in one go. Rather, it works by a process of successive approximation. Larger groups, groups that we call apobaramins, are split up, and smaller groups that we call monobaramins are added to, until all of the members of a particular created kind have been identified. For example, we may find evidence suggesting that the theropod dinosaurs should be split up into several different kinds, spinosaurs, allosaurs, megalosaurs, and so on. Or we may find evidence that a particular species of interest should be united, say, with the spinosaurs in a single created kind. So we have this process of successive approximation. And the goal is to converge on what we call the hollow baramin, the group that includes all of the members of the created kind in question, but no members of any other created kind. In other words, the whole created group. And this new toolkit of baraminology also includes a number of statistical methods that can help us to identify the created kinds. One of these methods is something called baraminic distance, which basically measures the percentage of characters that two organisms have in common with one another to determine how similar or dissimilar they are. By characters, we mean traits that help to differentiate species, that they're usually attributes of bones or skulls or teeth. So that's one method we can use. Another method is something called multidimensional scaling. Multidimensional scaling is a kind of clustering method that allows patterns of similarity and difference between organisms to be visualized three-dimensionally in three-dimensional space. Now, I'm not going to go into all of the technical details of these methods here. There's plenty of literature available out there if you want to find out more. But the point is that these methods, unlike hybridization, can be applied equally to fossil creatures as they can to living creatures. And in recent years, these new methods have been applied to a number of fossil groups, including the dinosaurs, with some very interesting results. The first ever baraminology study of dinosaurs was given at the annual meeting of the Creation Biology Society held in Rapid City in South Dakota back in 2011. I was one of the three co-authors of that study. In our study, we analysed 19 data sets, 19 dinosaur data sets, and we were able tentatively to identify about 8 dinosaur kinds. The first full-length paper on dinosaur baraminology, a study of tyrannosaurs, was published by Answers in Genesis in the Answers Research Journal back in 2014. In this study, the author analysed 4 different data sets, all focused on tyrannosaurs. But the most extensive study so far presented was in 2018 at the 8th International Conference on Creationism held in Pittsburgh. The lead author was Dr. Neil Duran of Bryan College in Dayton, Tennessee. And this particular study was also noteworthy for introducing a new statistical method to the baraminology toolkit. 18 data sets from the year 2004 were analysed using both the old and the new statistical methods, and another 19 data sets, more recent from 2009 to 2018, were analysed using only the new method. And again, several different dinosaur kinds were identified in this study. So let's have a look at some of the dinosaur kinds that have now been revealed by these studies. One of the dinosaur groups that was identified as a created kind was the Stegosauria, which in the standard taxonomic hierarchy is a suborder, a rank just between family and order. Stegosaurs walked on 4 legs. They had thin bony plates along their backs. They had paired spikes on their tails, sometimes on their shoulders as well. They ranged somewhat in size, from the largest that were maybe 29 and a half feet long down to the smaller ones that were maybe 15 feet long. The head was typically small. They had spoon-shaped teeth and a hard beak at the front. They were herbivores. They probably ate short leafy plants and fruits. And in our studies, it appears that all of the species within the stegosaur group were members of a single created kind that God made. Another created dinosaur kind was the Pachycephalosauria, also classified as a suborder in the standard taxonomy, so again, somewhere between a family and an order. Now, members of this group are commonly referred to as the bone-headed dinosaurs because they had skulls with a bony dome and often other types of head ornamentation such as spikes and nodules. Rival males may have used these to butt heads with one another. Some were quite small, about 3 feet long. Others were much larger, up to 15 feet long. But again, in our studies, they all seem to constitute a single created group. A third created kind was the Tyrannosauroidea, which is classified in the standard taxonomy as a superfamily. In other words, a rank just above the level of family. Of course, the most famous member of this group is Tyrannosaurus rex, which was about 46 feet long, would have weighed 8 tons in life. And most tyrannosaurs were, in fact, large animals with small arms and 2 fingers, although there were also smaller forms with longer arms and 3 fingers. And again, they all appear to have constituted a single created kind. And then a fourth created kind was the Hadrosauridae. These are classified as a family in the standard taxonomic hierarchy. Hadrosaurs are sometimes known as the duck-billed dinosaurs because they had these wide, toothless beaks, although in life probably the beak was covered in soft tissue. Hadrosaurs walked on 2 legs, so they were bipedal, but they held the body horizontally with the stiffened tail extended for balance. And there were 2 main types of hadrosaurs. There were the hadrosaurines with flat-topped skulls, and then there were the lambiosaurines with hollow head crests. They were probably all members of a single created kind, although some of the studies indicated that perhaps they may represent 2 separate created kinds, the hadrosaurines and the Lambeosaurids. So what can we say by way of summary here? So far, baraminologists have identified about 20 distinct dinosaur kinds. Our 2011 study identified about 8 kinds. The 2014 study identified one kind, the Tyrannosauroidea. And the 2018 study identified at least 17 kinds. Now note that those numbers don't add up to 20. That's because there was some overlap between the studies, and also they didn't always agree exactly on the conclusions to be drawn. But it gives us some idea of our current state of knowledge. Now the total number of dinosaur kinds will be greater than this when we get the final tally, because some dinosaur groups have not yet been studied in detail, and other groups have so far only given inconclusive results. For example, we need a great deal more work on the sauropod dinosaurs, the long-tailed, long-necked dinosaurs, and there are likely to be quite a few distinct sauropod kinds that will add substantially to this total. So that's one point. Another interesting point that comes out of these studies is that the results so far tend to confirm the earlier intuitions of creationists, that the created kind is at or near the taxonomic rank of family. Sometimes it seems equal to a family, sometimes it seems to be a little bit higher in the ranking than a family, perhaps a superfamily or a suborder. Sometimes it seems to be a little lower in the ranking, perhaps a subfamily. So the family seems a reasonable first approximation of what the created kind is. So we've made some very encouraging first steps towards identifying the kinds of dinosaurs that God made in the beginning. And I think this is exciting because it gives us a foundation that will eventually allow us to explore in more detail and begin to answer many of those other questions that we have about the dinosaurs. But of course, there's still a great deal more work for us to do. So that's taxonomy. Let's turn now from taxonomy to the second of those T's, taphonomy. Taphonomy, remember, refers to all of the processes by which dinosaurs and other organisms came to be preserved in the fossil record. This slide shows a magnificent mounted skeleton of a full-grown adult Allosaurus, one of the most iconic of the theropod dinosaurs. I'm afraid there are no prizes for guessing where this skeleton is on display. This is Ebenezer, the Allosaurus, on display at the Answers in Genesis Creation Museum in Kentucky, and one of the museum's star exhibits since the 24th of May in 2014. Ebenezer is 30 feet long and 10 feet tall, about average for its species. In life, it's estimated that this individual would have weighed more than 2 tons. And Ebenezer the Allosaurus has an absolutely fascinating story to tell. The partially complete skeleton of Ebenezer was discovered in the year 2000 by a creationist, Dana Forbes, on his land near Macedonia in the Skull Creek Basin of northwest Colorado. It was excavated between 2001 and 2002. 139 bones out of a possible 250 were recovered. So the skeleton is about 56% complete. But one of the most remarkable aspects of this specimen is its skull, which at about 97% complete and 3 feet long is probably the largest and most complete Allosaurus skull that has ever been found. The skull has 53 teeth, each averaging about 4.5 inches long, including the roots. And in this specimen, even the delicate hyoid bones are intact. Now, the hyoids are the delicate bones that would have anchored the muscles of the tongue and the larynx. and help with swallowing and vocalization. These bones are almost never found intact in fossils. So this is a very significant specimen. Over the last few years, creationists have been doing some very interesting research in connection with this world-class dinosaur specimen. Firstly, they've conducted a careful field investigation of the site where the skeleton was discovered in order to gather as much information as possible about how Ebenezer came to be buried and preserved at that location. Dr. Andrew Snelling, the Director of Research at Answers in Genesis, and Dr. John Whitmore, Professor of Geology at Cedarville University in Ohio, along with some of Dr. Whitmore's students, visited the site in March 2014 to measure the rock section and to sample the dig site, and we'll take a look at some of the things that they found. And then secondly, in November 2016, the Creation Museum had Ebenezer's skull scanned using computer imaging, which is also revealing more details about the life and death of this remarkable animal. And thanks to Dr. Snelling at AIG, I can today show you some of those computer scans of Ebenezer's skull. So let's begin with the site investigation. Ebenezer was found in an Upper Jurassic rock unit called the Morrison Formation. It's a very famous and rather extraordinary set of rock layers that extends across the Rocky Mountain region from Canada to New Mexico. The Morrison covers about 700,000 square miles, and it averages about 245 feet thick. Dinosaurs are found fossilized at many levels throughout this formation, and the Morrison is famous for its fossil graveyards, including the Carnegie Quarry at Dinosaur National Monument in Utah. Many well-known and iconic dinosaurs, such as Stegosaurus and Allosaurus, were named from specimens that were excavated from the Morrison Formation. This photograph shows the actual dig site in Moffat County in Colorado, where Ebenezer was recovered. The carcass was found lying on its left side on a steep slope. The hip and the limb bones, if they were originally present, would have been sticking out of the hillside and may have been eroded away. Now, the Morrison Formation has several subdivisions called members. The uppermost of those subdivisions is known as the Brushy Basin member. And this is the part of the Morrison Formation in which Ebenezer was found. Now, the Brushy Basin member is particularly notable for containing a huge quantity of volcanic material, at least 4,300 cubic miles of volcanic debris are contained within the Brushy Basin member of the Morrison. And this volcanic material must have been transported a very great distance. We know that because the nearest volcanic vents are way out in the west in Southern California and Nevada. The Morrison Formation typically consists of a few hard, resistant sandstone layers, and then other sandstone layers which are more easily weathered and eroded because of all the volcanic clays and other volcanic components. The sampling of the sediments at the dig site revealed that the sediments there are typical of Morrison sediments. They're what we call poorly sorted sandstones. In other words, there's a wide range of grain sizes. They have angular grains of quartz, fragments of chert, and pebbles from a volcanic source. All of this gives us some important clues to the processes that must have deposited the sediments in which Ebenezer was found. Now, we've already noted that Ebenezer is about 56% complete. The parts of the skeleton that have been preserved include the skull, most of the neck vertebrae, some of the tail vertebrae, and part of an upper leg bone, plus some other bones. Now, some of these bones were still articulated. In other words, they were still in the correct anatomical position relative to one another, which suggests that soft tissues and ligaments were still holding parts of the body together at the time that Ebenezer was buried. That's a strong indication that this carcass must have been buried rapidly soon after death. However, other parts of Ebenezer are missing, and there are several possible reasons for this. Obviously, some parts of the skeleton are more delicate than others and so less likely to be preserved. And some bones were probably lost by exposure and erosion at the dig site. However, another reason why some of the skeleton is missing is that the body appears to have been partially ripped apart at the time it was transported and buried. This type of partial preservation, with specimens missing their head or missing a tail or perhaps consisting only of articulated vertebrae or limbs, actually seems to be quite common in dinosaurs found in the Morrison Formation. And also, interestingly, smaller animals are more likely to be found complete than larger animals. Again, these are all clues that help us to piece together how this animal came to be preserved here. So how was Ebenezer buried at this location? Can we come up with a scientific model that explains all of the available information? Now, in the conventional long age model, it's usually suggested that these Morrison dinosaurs died in dry stream beds under conditions of drought, and that their carcasses were then later picked up and transported and buried during occasional flash flood events. However, Dr. Snelling and Dr. Whitmore have proposed another explanation that seems to fit the data better. Their model suggests that at least some of the Morrison Formation sandstone layers were deposited as catastrophic mass flow deposits rather than by flash flooding. And this seems to explain many of the features of the sediments at the dig site better, as well as features of the carcass itself. Now, in this new explanation, massive volcanic eruptions to the west generated catastrophic debris flows that swept through this region at the time of the worldwide flood. Remember that a huge amount of the material found in these sandstone layers has a volcanic origin. And the carcasses of animals that were caught up by these mass flows could often have been transported reasonably intact, especially if they were small. But differential shearing forces within the flow would have tended to rip larger carcasses apart. And this would explain the kind of preservation that we see in Ebenezer and many of the other Morrison dinosaurs, where in this case much of the middle of the body is missing because the carcass has literally been ripped into two. Now, Dr. Snelling and Dr. Whitmore plan to write up their work, the results of their field investigation, and so you can look out for that when it appears, I assume, in the Answers Research Journal. Now, another approach to studying Ebenezer is to examine the skeleton using computer imaging. And so in November 2016, AIG's research department contracted with an engineering company based in Cincinnati in Ohio to conduct a computer tomography investigation of Ebenezer's skull. This company's industrial scanner is one of only five or six like it in the United States. It's able to penetrate dense materials such as fossil bone with a very high resolution. And that allows us to see details of this specimen's internal anatomy without having to cut the specimen up into sections, which is what scientists in years gone by used to have to do. And here we can see some of the computer tomography images of Ebenezer. Here focusing on the right side of the skull, up in the top left. You can see the back of the skull in the top right. The top of the skull, you're looking down at the top of the skull on the bottom left. And you'll notice that the skull is very thin. That's because it's been laterally compressed. It's been flattened during burial. And then in the lower right, you can see the brain cavity, the scan of the brain cavity, which is revealing details of the brain lobes, even the cranial nerves. It's expected that these CT scans will allow a full and very detailed anatomical description of this skull to be made, revealing lots of details which would be very difficult to determine simply by physical examination. We may even be able to determine whether Ebenezer was male or female. And so far as we know, this is the very first time that an Allosaurus skull has been scanned in this way. So this is cutting edge research, and it's being done by creationists at the Creation Museum. AIG are planning to make the scans available to other researchers so that comparisons can be made to other specimens of the same species and more can be discovered. So if you haven't already made your plans to go to visit the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter, then why not take the opportunity to do that? It's really very well worth visiting, and you'll be able to see Ebenezer for yourself. Well, in the final section of my talk, I want to tell you about a remarkable dinosaur dig that has been going on since 1996 at a remote cattle ranch in northeastern Wyoming. Early explorations at this site uncovered many fossil specimens. And it soon became obvious that this location was the location of a major bed of dinosaur bones. Since that time, back in the mid-90s, a creationist by the name of Dr. Arthur Chadwick, who you can see here in this slide, and his colleagues have been going back to this site and excavating at the site and recovering about 1,000 bones every year. So, a huge number of dinosaur bones are preserved here. And what's really interesting about the work that Dr. Chadwick and his team are doing is that they're using pioneering methods to study this remarkable bone bed. Very often when beds of dinosaur bones like this are excavated, a lot of information can be lost during the excavation. But what this team are doing is they're using high precision GPS technology, satellite technology, with a resolution of 1 centimeter or less to record the position and the orientation of every bone as it's extracted from the ground. They're also taking digital photographs of the bones at the time of excavation, and then using computer technology, the GPS coordinates are being combined with the photographs to reconstruct the bone bed as it would have appeared in the ground in 3 dimensions. So these methods, these pioneering methods, allow the researchers to capture the 3-dimensional relationships between the bones, which allows us to preserve all kinds of information that would have been lost by more traditional methods of excavation. And the aim is to try to understand how the bone bed formed. So let's take a look at some of the key discoveries and some of the key observations that have been made by Dr. Chadwick and his team, and the model that they've proposed to try to explain them. And the first observation that we can make about this site concerns how many bones are being found. 20 or 30 bones per square meter is common. In total, about 13,000 bones, bone fragments, and teeth have so far been recovered from 7 quarries that have been excavated into the main bone bed. And that is only a small fraction of what still remains in the ground. Now, most of these bones come from one type of dinosaur, a large duck-billed plant eater called Edmontosaurus. Although occasionally the remains of some other dinosaurs are found, along with the remains of other animals such as crocodiles and turtles and fishes. It's been estimated that perhaps 25,000 Edmontosaurus dinosaurs are buried here, probably representing more than one herd of animals. So that's the first observation, a huge concentration of bones. But secondly, the dinosaur bones are found in a single layer of mudstone. This layer of mudstone averages about 3.25 feet in thickness, and the bones are mostly suspended in the mud. They kind of float, if you like, in the mud. They're not directly touching one another. It's not like the bones have piled up touching one another. They're embedded within the mud. This mudstone layer is thickest in the northwest, and it gets thinner towards the south. And immediately above the bone bed is a layer of sandstone with features indicating that it was deposited rapidly. The contact between the mudstone layer that contains the bones and the sandstone above is sharp and flat, and below the bone bed is a mudstone at the north end and a muddy sandstone at the south end. So this is a remarkable layer, and it's a single layer that contains all of these thousands of bones. Another very notable feature is that we have discovered this because of those pioneering techniques where you can preserve the three-dimensional relationships of the bones as they were in the ground. Another notable feature is that these dinosaur bones are sorted by size. So the biggest bones, such as the upper leg bones, the femurs, are typically found at the bottom, and the smallest bones, such as individual vertebrae and toe bones, are found at the top. So, for example, here we can look at a series of slices from the bottom of the bone bed through to the top of the bone bed. This is at the base, and you can see that there are the big limb bones. But then as we go up through the bed, you'll notice that the bones get smaller in size. See that? So they're graded by size. The biggest bones at the bottom, and they get smaller as you go up through the bone bed. Now this is very significant. This is what geologists call a graded bed. And that is a very important observation, which we'll come back to. Another observation concerns the articulation of the bones. Now, occasionally, 2 or 3 bones are found in articulation, perhaps bits of a spinal column or something like that. That suggests that maybe they were joined together by soft tissues at the time they were buried. But in fact, for most of the bones, that's not the case. Most of the bones are not joined together. They are not in articulation with one another. They are disarticulated. And in fact, no entire dinosaur carcasses, like Ebenezer, have been found in this bone bed. There are no intact carcasses in this, or even partially intact carcasses in the bone bed. And then a final observation is that when the bones are examined, we discover that there is very little evidence that these bones were ever exposed to weathering or were bleached by the sun before they were buried. There are also few signs of damage caused by the transport of the bones before they were buried. There are, however, some tooth marks on the bones, which suggests that the carcasses may have been scavenged before burial, and some of the bones have fractures, they're broken, perhaps by being trampled upon. So the question is, can we now put all of these clues together to try to work out how this remarkable bone bed was deposited? Now, this bone bed is part of the Upper Cretaceous Lance Formation. Like the Morrison, the Lance Formation is an extraordinary rock unit. It can be traced across much of Wyoming, and it has close equivalents in many other states. So it's a remarkably widespread rock unit. Now, conventional long-age geologists think that the sandstones and the mudstone layers in the Lance Formation were deposited slowly by freshwater streams that were meandering across a broad coastal plain about 66 million years ago. And this has tended to give rise to the idea that the bone beds which we find in the Lance Formation built up over very long periods of time as migrating herds of dinosaurs tried to cross major river systems. You know the picture that you get from modern wildlife documentaries. You have herds of animals like wildebeest that migrate. They come to a major geographical barrier like a river which they have to cross. And some of those animals each season will be drowned, washed downstream, and their carcasses will accumulate on a sandbank or on a river bar or at a bend in the river. And this is the picture that most scientists have when they think about the Lance Formation bone beds. We have these migrating herds of dinosaurs crossing these rivers. Some of the dinosaurs would be swept downstream, and over time, hundreds of carcasses would build up as the river slowly switched its position. Perhaps an extensive layer of dinosaur bones would accumulate. And clearly all of this would have been a very slow process. It would have required thousands and thousands and thousands of years to build up a substantial layer of bones. The problem is that the discoveries that have been made by Dr. Chadwick and his team at the dig site in Wyoming tell us that there is something very wrong with that idea. Consider the data that we've looked at. Firstly, the bones are encased in what? They're encased in mud. They're in a mudstone. Mud is not the type of sediment that we normally associate with fast-flowing rivers. Fast-flowing rivers tend to deposit coarse sediments, such as sands and gravels. Secondly, the bones are suspended in the mud. Remember, they're not in contact with one another. They're floating in the mud. And what that tells us is that both the mud and the bones were transported as a single mass. And that would require some kind of mud flow rather than normal river transport. Thirdly, the bones, remember, are found in a single layer. Not multiple layers that were laid down seasonally over a long period of time, one layer. And they're sorted by size, from the bottom to the top. What does that tell us? It tells us that those bones were separated out by size during transport. It tells us that they were deposited in one go, not in multiple events over a long period of time. If that deposit had accumulated over many years, every type of bone would be represented at every level throughout the mudstone, right? But they're not. They're separated out. Fourthly, The mudstone layer contains multitudes of disconnected bones. We don't find complete or even partially complete carcasses, as you'd expect if the bodies of animals had accumulated on a sandbank somewhere. The bones would largely be deposited as a single carcass. So putting all of these pieces of the puzzle together, Dr. Chadwick and his colleagues have proposed a very different model, one that they think better fits the data. They've suggested that tens of thousands of dinosaurs perished in some kind of catastrophe. Then their bodies must have lain around for just long enough to rot and to be scavenged in order to explain why the bodies were falling apart and some showed signs of having been bitten or trampled upon. But the bones couldn't have been exposed for very long because the bones are pristine. They don't show sign of long periods of weathering. So what happened is very shortly after this, this entire rotting mass, this putrid mass of tens of thousands of dinosaurs must have been picked up by a huge, fast-moving mudflow, perhaps triggered by a large earthquake, and swept southwards into deeper water, where the bones eventually came to rest embedded in the mud. This explains the type of sediment in which the bones are embedded, the sorting of the bones by size, and the other features of the mudstone layer. Now, of course, we can't scientifically prove that these events happened during Noah's flood, but the kind of catastrophic scenario that is being revealed by these discoveries at this remarkable site is certainly consistent, isn't it, with what we'd expect with the biblical flood model. At the very least, we can say that the standard long age model of how this bone bed formed fails to explain the data. And if you'd like more information about the Wyoming dig site, then there is a very informative website that you can visit to find out more. So let's try to summarise some of what we've said in this talk. We've looked at a number of examples of cutting-edge research that creationists are doing in order to understand dinosaurs from a biblical perspective. This scientific work includes statistical studies of fossil data sets to determine the number of created dinosaur kinds. The examination of world-class dinosaur specimens with the application of computer imaging techniques. Field studies to understand how dinosaurs died and were transported and buried during the worldwide flood. And long-term excavation projects to unravel the origin and depositional history of major dinosaur bone beds. All of these projects that I've described today not only make significant contributions to the development of the creationist model of Earth history, they also add to our overall database of scientific knowledge. And I believe they show that young age creationism can provide a very fruitful and productive framework for scientific discovery. I want to say some thank yous to Dr. Snelling, to Dr. Chadwick and Rose Weeks for some of the photographs that we've used in the talk today. And before I hand back to Simon and we can all go and have our dinner, I just wanted just to mention the Biblical Creation Trust stand, which is in the exhibition hall. It's in the room just over there to my right. Do please come and visit us and see the literature that we have available. We've got lots of free materials as well to give away, and you can sign up to receive our free newsletter. We've got a number of books and DVDs for sale. We also have a series of booklets we launched a while ago, a series called Biblical Creation Basics. And number one is called I'm a Creationist, Get Me Out of Here. And this was a booklet that I wrote really to try to give some practical tips and advice to students who are creationists, who are wondering, what do I do when I'm confronted with evolution in the classroom? How do I handle that situation? It's helpful also for parents and others who want to be able to advise their young people. And there are copies of that available for £1. My colleague, Dr. Stephen Lloyd, wrote number two in the series, Adam or Death, which came first. That's a very helpful theological explanation of our biblical creation position, showing how this question of origins matters for the gospel and for science and for apologetics. Number three in the series has just been published. It's hot off the press. It arrived just this week. For those of you who were here at the 2017 mega conference, this is the write-up of the talk that I gave on that occasion. Many people came up to me afterwards and were interested in where they could have that information written down. So I've written it up as a booklet, and it's available. It's in full colour, lots of illustrations, and that's available for £4 on the book table. And it really just helps us to address the plausibility of a young world. One of the big challenges that we face as creationists, a kind of hurdle that we have when we talk to others about our biblical creation position, is the supposed implausibility of the young earth position. And in that talk and in the booklet, I try to suggest an approach that helps us not only get over that barrier of plausibility, but actually turns the tables and shows that the standard geological timescale based on radiometric dating actually has a whole series of plausibility problems of its own. And so it's perhaps a very helpful resource as we talk to others. So thank you very much for your attention. Do come and visit us on the stand, and wherever Simon is, I'll hand back to him. Thank you.